Chloe, I am a machine, a robot. I can't stop painting. I haven't shaved in 2 days, and I can't imagine what I smell like. My hair is so greasy that it's staying in a ponytail even though I pulled out the elastic hours ago, days ago, and used it to smudge some charcoal on a canvas. There is nothing romantic about it. I'm in a trance, and if the fire alarm started blaring, I would probably stay here and die, because this is the most peaceful time to me, submerged in this thing outside of myself that reduces my body to a tool, my mind removed from my corporeal state, this floating thing that doesn't know about fire, showers, engagement rings. That brings me out of my work and back onto the balcony. I stagger. I sink into one of Carrig's overstuffed, heavenly chairs selected by his interior designer. The city is still there, not burning. I pick up the ring that's been on the floor. What a stupid place to keep an engagement ring. The poor piece of jewelry is dried to the tile, sealed in black paint. Asshole, I mutter. You really are an asshole. Carrig's mom stocked our cleaning products, so fortunately we have the good stuff, the stuff nobody we know has anymore, the hardcore chemical cleaning products that kill you slowly as they make your floors sparkle. I dab a paper towel into some liquid blue. But I'm dizzy again. I don't know when I last ate, and I put a Hot Pocket into the microwave. Thank you, Carrig's mom. And I sit on the floor. I'm too dirty to sit in any of this nice furniture. Too mangy to sleep in his bed. Our bed. I don't know. I froze up on him when he proposed. Instead of saying yes, I said nothing. A couple minutes later, he slipped the ring off my finger. He opened the refrigerator. Carrig, we should talk.
Oh, for fuck's sake, he said. This is fucking almond milk.
Care, look at me. But he slammed the door. I told him his milk was in the back. I always get you the regular milk. Because I love you. He grabbed the door handle, but it was stuck. It's an energy saver design where the refrigerator won't open immediately after you shut it. He snapped on me, screaming, kicking.
Even this fucking fridge is a little bitch. Fucking A, Chloe, just leave me alone.
But I didn't leave. I stayed. A minute later, he opened the refrigerator and found his milk in the back, his 2% cow's milk.
I'm sorry, he said. I just don't get it.
I told him this was about me. I wasn't painting anymore. I was on the way to becoming one of those women in Sunday styles who gives up her job the day she gets married. He hugged me. It was comforting to feel his hands on my back.
I promise you'll paint, he said,
as if a person you love can promise you what you'll do. But isn't it why you get married in the first place? So that someone can row the boat when you're tired. He was logical, pouring cow's milk onto his cereal, telling me that the marriage would actually be good for me.
You would have all this stuff to do with the wedding, and it would be demanding, and the kind of stuff you would hate, talking to your mom, talking to my mom.
I don't hate your mom, Care. He smiled.
You always do better when you have too much to do, he said. When painting is like a rebellion or something.
I could have said yes right then. It doesn't get more supportive than that. How he didn't turn this into being about his bruised ego, storm off in some passive-aggressive, John-based rage. I could feel the word inside of me, multiplying, echoing, yes, yes, yes. But I didn't say it. The next morning, he woke me up when he was already showered, dressed.
I gotta go to Hong Kong, he said.
Are you kidding?
I think it's great timing, he said, backing away from the bed, checking his hair in the mirror. I was floored.
Carrig, I don't want you to leave because of me. I told you this is my shit, not yours.
He put the ring on the nightstand.
I know, he said. And it's the same way with me. The Asian market has nothing to do with you.
At first, we talked every day, but then every day turned into every other day. Now, I haven't heard from him in over a week. I know he's okay. The internet has eliminated so much wonder and romance. I wish I couldn't know. I wish I could prove my love by getting onto a boat and going to find him, only to arrive and find that he had already set sail to return to me, a gift of the Magi tragedy where we'd be doomed by our love, our bad timing. I haven't let the cleaning lady come since he's been away, but there's no way around it. His leaving is the best thing that's happened to me in a long time. I haven't painted this much since John left, and it was all new to me, drawing, those fresh calluses on my palms, on my fingers. I look around the apartment, canvases everywhere. They're all John. His eyes, that excessively circular shape. Most eyes are slightly almond.
The microwave chirps, and by the time I open the door, the previously frozen hot pocket is lukewarm, almost cold.
I look around at all the Johns stuffed into Carrig's apartment. And then I'm back on the floor, crying. I started drawing when John was kidnapped, and now I'm back in the same place. Carrig is gone, in pain, and his agony is fuel. I don't want to be this person, this parasitic vampire who thrives most when the people who love her are ailing, when they're underground, sleeping, trapped, or on the other side of the world on Facebook, photographing their sushi, trying so hard to be okay for me, me, who is here betraying them, fueled by male pain. I slap paint over every single great big John. And when the paint is dry, I cover those canvases with the view from Carrig's apartment. Carrig finally calls, and I answer on the first ring.
Hi, he says.
Oh, it's so good to hear your voice, Carr. I feel his fear dissipating. I did that. Same way I painted all these skylines.
Yeah, he says. Because I wasn't sure.
Carrig, of course I'm sure. I want to see you. Are you back yet?
Do you want me to be?
Yes, I say, cradling the phone, fixing my eyeliner. My legs look good, waxed and spray tanned. I feel good. He deserves to feel good, too. I like the ring on my finger. I want to show him that I'm better. Let him see my canvases, the proof of my happiness, my productivity, the proof that his proposal, the clarity of our future, had lifted me to a new place, a better place. I look around at all the paintings, the ones that were all John just 2 days ago, the ones that I painted over religiously, monotonously. Every time I erased one of his faces, I was a little more loaded in this world, the real world, than that one. Like scooping water off a sinking boat. They're all landscapes now. They're the view from Carrig's balcony. They're not going to get me any prizes. Nobody's going to be dazzled. But then Carrig arrives, and he hugs me. He holds me. He gasps at all the landscapes. I roll my eyes. Are you kidding? Carr says. These are amazing. This is our view, babe. I am sheepish, mumbling something about landscapes being basic. Chloe, are you kidding? You couldn't do basic even if you tried. These look like you. All your stuff always has that you thing going on. Isn't that why it sells? But I don't want the praise. It's too soon. People have painted this skyline, and I didn't bring anything new to it. We go back and forth, and he can't beat me when it comes to art, and then he waves me off and squats in front of the biggest one. He looks like a frog. Care, I say, what are you doing? You're an artist because I swear you can feel something underneath. I don't know how to explain it. That's for you and the art people. But they're heavy. He doesn't see the color drain out of my face. I walk over to Carrig, my husband-to-be. I wrap my arms around his torso. I close my eyes and breathe him in. I love you so much, I say. So, so much. The next morning, Carrig says he never saw me look so happy in my sleep. I kiss him. I missed you, I say. And now we're here. While he's showering, I'm on wedding websites. I'm starting a registry and I'm emailing my mom. She wants to have an engagement party right away, and this feels like a new chapter. Something better than a blank canvas. It's a layered foundation, and there's no excavating what's underneath.
Eggs. They gave me a new parking spot, a handicap spot closer to the entrance. Screw you, Stacy, I'm not an old man. I drove here on my own, I beat cancer. I think I can make it through a goddamn parking lot. And look at her, up front, clapping, whistling, making everyone stand up, and here I am, taking a bow like a damn prom queen. There's cake and small talk, and Lo was wrong. It's not good to be back. Not good to be so aware of everyone inspecting me, sizing me up, looking for my bag. And then it ends. Mercy. But Stacy follows me into my office. She closes the door. So, she says, Lo's really all right with you coming back? Of course, I say. She's been amazing. She's my rock. She winks. She knows. She drops a manila envelope on my desk. There's your fan mail. She doesn't close my door as she goes. The return address on the envelope is Stanford University, and inside there is a letter. Dear Detective De Benedictus, you gave me your card, and I promised to let you know if I had any more information for you on the bearded man I spoke to. I was up the other night watching Dateline, procrastinating, an overview of wanted criminals and kidnapping and other American achievements. Anyhow, I realize that I do know the bearded man, but his name isn't Theo Ward. You might remember him, too. They called him Basement Boy. His name is John Bronson. You might remember the case. It was a strange one. He was kidnapped by a substitute teacher. He eventually escaped, but he had been in an induced coma for 4 years. I've been reading about it. I understand why the boy was drawn to Lovecraft, themes of isolation, but I suppose that's not of use to you. Anyhow, I'm sure that the young man I spoke to about the Dunwich Horror was Theo Ward, as in Basement Boy, John Bronson. I'm also sure that you have the resources to take it from here. I hope this letter finds its way to you. I emailed you and got your out-of-office bounce back. Perhaps a colleague will pass this along the old-fashioned way. I hope that you are well, Detective. Sincerely, Dr. Lin Wu. I read the letter again. The beard had no childhood until now. He was just this loner for me, this creature of the streets. Fake names, I am Providence. No friends, no home, no past. That's what gets me most about this letter, the idea that in all the time I was trying to find him, I never wondered about where he came from and how he came to be this person. I was focused on the present, what he did now, how he did it. And now I have a backstory, an origin story. I remember the basement boy's stories in the news, and they're all still there online. One day this kid's walking to school, and then he's gone. And then 4 years later he pops up at a mall in Nashua, calls his mother from a New Age store. He was home a bit, Skyping interviews with talk shows. He never went back to school, and according to his parents, he's on his own, living out of the spotlight. John Bronson. The beard has a name. He has parents, Mr. and Mrs. Jed and Penny Bronson. I have to find them, see them. I Google the Dunwich Horror, but I don't have the attention span to tackle literary criticism right now. I have a name. The beard has a name. It's a new world. I crack my knuckles. I put the name in quotes. John Bronson. I read everything I could find about Basement Boy, current whereabouts unknown. I watched the Dateline clips, the Ellen segment where he showed them his bedroom via Skype, the usual things, a few more Spider-Man posters than you might expect for a kid his age. I dug up the coverage in the Telegraph. I saw how they hunted for him, how they didn't. The kid only had one friend, as far as I could tell, a girl named Chloe Sayers. She's at the vigils. She's quoted, "Not a popular kid, John Bronson. Amazing what you can feel from an objective article in a small-town paper. The whiff of obligation." I read about the perp, Roger Blair, substitute teacher. The man disappeared, and though they're still looking for him, it's clear that he's a low priority. After all, John Bronson was healthy as a horse when he emerged from that basement cluttered with houseplants. The public was fired up for a few minutes about finding the man. A substitute teacher, access to our kids, how did this happen? But Bronson, who wasn't what you'd call a local treasure when he went missing, emerges a muscle-bound man. That's a story that hits and sucks the air out of the perpetrator tires. Well, whatever he did to the kid, let's face it, the kid is fine, and at least he didn't take our kids. Blair has a long history of mental illness, most of which was regarded as idiosyncrasy, because the man was Ivy League educated, employed as a professor. When you're smart and sick, people are prone to see you as gifted, touched. So, while Roger's former boss was quick to point the finger, "This is why I fired him. I knew he was capable of something awful," he didn't go to the authorities on his own. He waited until the bad thing actually did happen. The most interesting thing about it is the mystery of those 4 years. Bronson claims he can't remember a thing, and Blair is out of the picture, off the grid, missing, wanted, same as John was when he was gone. Missing. Wanted. I read it all, everything I can get my hands on. I can't leave my office right away. I don't want it to be obvious that I've had a breakthrough. Come on, Eggie, calm the hell down. And then I pop the lock on my door and step out into the bullpen. Right away, I catch Stacy's eye. She wants to know what I've been up to all these hours. And I point to the last thing in the world she wants to hear about. My bag. She waves me off, and I'm free to go. I feel like a kid on the last day of school, stepping out of that station, into the sun, getting into the car. I hit the road, New Hampshire bound. I'm a typical roadie in the sense that I think we're the best. In Massachusetts, you have all these sweet-toothed mass holes stuffing their faces with ice cream covered in jimmies, all puffed up with self-righteousness they get out of that little rock down Plymouth. Never mind Maine. Try being a woman in that state. Let me know how it works out. Vermont has the worst Italian food I ever had in my life. And New Hampshire, all you gotta know is that they take pride in rocks, granite, tax-free shopping, and bottle rockets. Their handles of grain alcohol, so they can go home and light themselves on fire. I start my car. I don't blame you for coming to Providence, John. I would, too. I use my handicap sticker to park by one of the main entrances to the Finch Plaza Mall. This is where Blair held the kid. This is where John Bronson became basement boy. The mall is any mall. Loud and sad, no mystique, no flair. The signs promise big doings. Coming soon. Excitement. But there's an atmosphere of doom, as in any mall these days, as if there are no surprises. Not anymore. It's late, so the stores are getting ready to close, but at least half of them are out of business. A sporting goods store called Rolling Jack's just went under. Paper on the window. The people working in the stores that look like they're still open are like statues, glued to their phones, their screens. The people in the few busy shops, the people running around helping customers, they look like they lost in life, like they're being punished, prisoners. I think of John Bronson, underground. What it must have been like for him to come up those stairs, to see the costume jewelry store and the cell phone kiosks. A mall. My phone's ringing. Low. I pick it up. She hears the noise. Yo, Lo, I say. She used to love that. But then YOLO became a thing that her kids say, the ones who aren't her favorites, and one day she told me not to say it anymore. She sighs. Stacy called. Fuck. Oh? Eggy, where are you? Don't make me call the phone company. Don't make me track your phone like you're a child. I sit down in an easy chair, hard as concrete. I'm in Nashua. Looking for the beard? She chuckles. Not a happy sound. She tells me this is it. She won't yell at me because I don't deserve it. There's no way to get through to me. I watch all the average children with their average parents coming, going. I let her rant at me. I promise this is it. It really is the end. And as I say that, I get the chills, because it's the truth. She wants me to eat. And I mean food, Eggie, not that fucking tea. And don't think this gets you out of Marco's party, either. Fuck. Of course, I'll be there. If Lo were to leave me, I'd wind up in a mall like this. One of these people in white sneakers and sweatpants carrying the 2-pound weights, walking the mall as if it's a racetrack. As if life's so good that I want it to last forever. When she finishes lecturing me, I tell her I'm sorry again. She says to pick up something for Marco and his fiancée. Me? You want me to get a gift for them?
Yes, you. You're in a mall, and I'm slammed.
What should I get?
Eggy, it's an engagement gift. You give something that lasts forever.
And then she's gone. Something that lasts forever. There's a store where they sell ripped jeans. A store where it's nothing but cell phone cases. A store where it's nothing but bras. I get a flash of Marco and his bride-to-be fucking on my kitchen table, and my skin heats up. Fuck them. I head to slot 14, the spot formerly occupied by Roger Blair. First things first. It was hell getting in there, tracking down a security guard to hear me out about the unoccupied space. He's finally coming, and I'm waving him down like some shit-out-of-luck guy on the side of the road with a flat. I try anyway, forcing small talk about the mall, the nice light, the sadness of seeing a sporting goods store go under. Locally owned? I ask. He nods. He scratches his nose. Listen, I'm short-staffed tonight. If you were hoping to get into this space, I can't do that for you.
There's a process and whatnot with the realtors. I get it. Sometimes the answer is yes. Yes. You have cancer. Sometimes the answer is no. No, you can't go in. I don't waste the guy's time by pitching a fit. It's not happening today. He drives off on his scooter, and I do the only thing you can do when they say no and you want yes. I get the hell out of there and find something else to do. The Bronsons live on a nowhere street in a nowhere part of town. Not enough trees to call it tree-lined, but it's not situated near any homespun five and dime. This is a practical place. Houses lined up because people need houses. I sit out here for a few minutes, waiting to catch a vibe, a sense of who these people are beyond the basics. The mother works at TJ Maxx, and she's a townie. The father's an import from Scotland. Landscapes, irregular. Hits the bottle is what I read between the lines. His red nose in the pictures from the Telegraph and his perpetually shifting business, roofing, lawns, back to roofing, as if he mucks it all up and starts fresh like a kid building castles on a beach. There's nothing else to know about them, and their house ain't talking, so I'm out of the car. I'm on the lawn, walking, trying to get my heart to slow down, my hands to stop shaking. I ring the bell. The father comes, Jed, red plastic cup in hand. I flash my badge. He grins, crooked teeth. Been a while since we heard from the boys in blue. He has that same Scottish accent he had in the news when his boy emerged and he scratched his chin for the local reporters, in awe, clearly half drunk. Come on in. Jed has done this before. He's an old pro, gesturing toward the sofa, offering me a beer. He tells his story in shifts. There was the first disappearance. We had no idea where he went, if he was dead, if he was here. You know, sometimes I'd swear he was in the attic. I tore it apart, took the floorboards up. Wife could have killed me. And he tells me about the return. You can't believe how big he got, how buff. You know, that's the last thing you expect. And then he talks about the time after the return. You know, it's like I say to my wife, he was never an easy kid. He was never one for people. He was always off with his hamsters, with his newspapers, so is it any wonder that he took off to be on his own? Do you know where he is now? He shakes his head. But you see, when I was a kid, my old man beat the pulp out of me. Oh, you don't know what it was, a different place. We're not so soft over there. Anyhow, I turned 17, I saved my pennies, and I got on a plane, and I came here, and that was it. You never saw your dad again? He finishes his scotch. Nope, not my mom nor my sister. And I told John about this. Oh, I told him the thing about being a man, a real man. You leave, you make your own family, and you pave your own road, and you don't go squatting on your old man's turf. He goes to set the boat off, which from the sounds in the kitchen means pour another drink. I pick up a photo album and look at pictures of John Bronson, young, smiling, awkward. Jed returns, offers me a beer. We aren't that much different, me and him. This house reminds me of my house, that sadness, that feeling of someone missing. I ask him when he last saw his son, and then he sighs. When Noel died. You know, the girl in his school. I remember because the wife, she took that hard. Didn't even know the kid, but oh, she cried. Was your son at that party? He shrugs. Who knows? All I know is that he was here that morning, and then he didn't come home, and then, well, that's all she wrote. He moans, America. Lorena Bobbitt, the one who cut off her husband's dick, she also copped insanity, served maybe 3 months, four, I can't remember. But there you go. He raises his red cup. There you goddamn go. Am I this bad? Do I openly stare into space trying to figure out what went wrong with Chucky? It occurs to me that I forgot to buy a present for Marco and his fiancée. That I might be even worse than I realize. Jed Bronson scratches his beard. I hate the quiet house. His eyes swing toward the old stereo system. CDs, big speakers.
You mind?
Of course not, I say. Outside, the sky is turning over, giving up. The day is going to end. I'm failing. John Bronson isn't here. You know when a man hasn't seen his son? The way Jed stands there, licking his thumbs, scraping gunk off a CD, waxing poetic about Simon and Garfunkel, America. That's me. That's him. That's any bad father, trying to make it like life is bigger than your son, when, come on, who's kidding who? And then he stops his bullshit yammering, and he looks at me all at once. Why did you say you're here? I think fast. I'm here because your son might have been a witness to something.
To something like a crime?
He asks. He doesn't take his eyes off me. Do I look that lost? That paranoid? Do I look that childish? That needy? That sagging skin, those sullen eyes.
Do you have a picture?
He asks.
You know, we haven't seen him. Who knows if we'd even recognize him?
He shakes his head. I realize how that sounds, but, you know, you wonder. And then we hear a car, and we both look out the window. He sighs. Here comes Penny. And there she is, slamming the door on her old Saab. She stopped off at the packy. She looks exhausted, still wearing her work smock, the lanyard, too. She's prettier than I expected, but she's given up. You can see that from the way she carries the bottle of booze with one hand. No bag, not hiding her need for it. Same way she doesn't cover the bags under her eyes. Badges of honor, proof that she's in mourning. Forever glum. She pauses when she comes in.
What is this, Jed? Aren't you going to introduce me?
This must look strange. Two grown men, Paul Simon blasting. And Jed introduces us, then excuses himself to put some Jack in his jack. When he's gone, Penny shuts off the music. There it is, in a nutshell. Why they belong together, why they don't. He plays the music, she shuts it down. I think of their boy in the middle of this fight, on his own in all the pictures. I bet he wanted a brother or sister. I bet he asked them for one. I bet he never got what he wanted, which is why he was clinging to that hamster the day he disappeared. Do you want to see his room? Jed asks when he returns. The three of us file upstairs to John's room. They kept it this way, just in case. There are the Spider-Man posters I saw online, boxes of newspapers. John lived for the paper, and upon closer inspection, I see that the pillowcases are also Spider-Man. How old was he when he left? I ask. Penny folds her arms. It's a touchy subject.
John was a kid at heart, she says. He was never trying to impress other people.
Jed picks up a Spider-Man pillow. You can tell he's never touched it before.
Pretty sure we put these on for Penn's cousin's kid when he visited, though, right, hon?
Penny doesn't answer, and I lead the way out the door, walking ahead so they can elbow each other. Don't lie to the man. Don't humiliate the boy. It's amazing how much you can hear in the silence of two married people. This is police work. It's listening. It's letting the worst of someone, their pain, crawl inside of you and blossom. Ugly. Awful. Back downstairs, things relax a little.
Mrs. Bronson doesn't encourage me to call her by her first name, and she doesn't take off her smock or her lanyard. She is awkward, nervous. Swears she has no clue where John is. Uses that word, clue. Means she's trying to figure it out. Means she has a clue, but I keep this to myself and just keep pushing. Do you ever hear from him? Penny shrinks up into herself.
No. No, I don't.
She's lying. She said, no, I don't, separating herself from her husband. She would have said, no, we don't, if she was telling the truth. Jed has no idea. The boy must call the mother. It's like me and Lo when someone asks us how Chucky's doing. I nod, and Lo does all the talking. I'm quiet because I'm a liar. The most I'll say is good. I heard he's good. And that's the equivalent of no. No, I don't. She asks if I have kids. Without meaning to, I lie. Tell her I don't.
John. I search for NC, and it's begun. Her body was discovered. But the reports are confusing. They bury the lead. They bury her name. The news isn't so much about NC's body, her untimely death. She's mentioned in passing, an afterthought for the real story, what they found in her basement. What's drawn the attention of the national news? 5 young girls. They were bound and gagged. The video is the kind of thing that sets the world on fire. These girls released, broken, shielding their faces as they file out of NC's house. I remember what Roger said to me in that letter. You are free. I wonder if these girls feel that. It doesn't seem remotely possible, but it's a comfort to know that they're on their way to something else, something better. I ended NC's ruthless reign. That's what the local paper called it. It's not what you think. I'm not a monster. I'll never rejoice in ending anyone's life, no matter what, but this particular case is special. I made the national news, the New York Times, indirectly, but still. This is the kind of thing they describe as a miracle. I watched the coverage, and for the first time in my life since all this, I'm almost grateful for my power. Finally, something good came of it. Something as magical as innocent girls exiting a house of horrors. The firemen came when the bathroom flooded and started an electric fire. I did the right thing leaving her in the bathroom. And that wasn't easy, but I did it. And because of me, those girls are free. I order myself a reward. The best cake in Lynn, strawberries and cream from Domici's. My doorbell rings, and the guy pounds on the door. Peter Fader? It's weird to hear my fake name. I crack the window and whistle to the guy on my stoop. Hey, buddy, I say. Can you leave it by the door? There's $5 under the mat. The delivery guy waves. Thanks. The smell of the bakery floods my whole apartment, and I breathe it in, close my eyes. Chloe smells like cookies. I eat the cake right out of the box, the way my mom did sometimes, and I read everything I can about the girls, their parents who were scared, their friends who thought they were gone. One girl was kidnapped in Vietnam. Another girl is local, from Southie. More is coming out every few minutes about the level of horror in that basement. NC brainwashed them with SpaghettiOs and heroin. She forced them to eat the noodles from the can, take the needle, inject themselves. She was working for a larger human trafficking conglomerate. The worst guys. The worst guys that can be. I hear Magnus in my head.
We did good work down here, John.
I finally made those words come true. And there is no we. It was only me. I rescued those girls. Even though I didn't know I was doing it, the truth is simple. If I hadn't walked into her house and surprised her in her shower, those girls would still be down there, trapped. I put on some hippocampus, and I look at what's left of my great big cake. It looks like a wedding cake, like the bride and groom got to it, and everybody laughed. The one thing begins, and I don't fight it. Not tonight. I go with it. I daydream of holding her, sharing my cake with her. Oh, I missed this. I missed her. I picture us standing before our friends, her friends, and our families. And she's in a white dress, and I'm beside her. My hand is on the small of her back. She's offering me cake, and I'm shaking my head, and then she smothers me with it, frosting in my mouth, filling my eyes. There's so much laughter you can't hear anything above it until she wraps her hand around my head and pulls me in for a kiss. Strawberries. Her tongue. Different from Flory's. Things are gonna be different now because I'm gonna be different now. No more guilt. No more doomsday. I start a deep clean on my apartment. I want things to feel good because I feel good, and I pour bleach into a bucket and mix it with water. And then my phone buzzes. A Google alert about Chloe. I get these all the time. They're usually nothing too exciting. She's in the listings for an art show, something like that. But this is one of the good ones because this is my day. I sit on the floor of my nice, clean kitchen with my back against the oven, and I open the email. I picture her next to me. I can imagine that, in a way I couldn't when I was so gloomy. My heart beats before the link even opens. A great big article about her in Nylon magazine. I'm happy to see her back in the news like this. I like the idea of us both making something of ourselves at the same time, in our own ways. And my heart is racing. That little beach ball of death is circling. I haven't allowed myself to do this in a while. To read about her, to look at pictures of her. And it felt like a two-way street, the way she slipped off screen, as if she and Dr. Actor were on a permanent break from the world. I bet they broke up. I bet she started painting a lot. I bet that's what this is, a return. And then the page opens, all the bright colors, her bright eyes. Chloe. First I look at the pictures. Her face is more of a heart than circle now, and her eyes are lined in this way they never were before. She's a little older, a little paler, a little more beautiful. She's in a shirt I've never seen, a New Hampshire Ringer t-shirt that says, "Live free or die." "I miss you too, Chloe," I tell her. I put my hand on her shirt. The next three pictures of her come from a photo booth. She's open in the first one, smiling. She's goofy in the second, and the third one gives me the chills. Her eyes, same as they were that day I got home, when she fainted. When she saw me. The article starts out talking about her painting. She's doing landscapes now, but Chloe's landscapes are creating a need for a new genre of upside-down kitsch. Her paintings are selling like crazy in New York, but also in other parts of the world, Paris and Amsterdam and Stockholm. I knew she'd come back, but I'd be lying if it didn't sting a little that this is the first article I've ever seen where they're not talking about me, the inspiration behind her eyes. And I shouldn't be upset to see that she's left my eyes behind and moved on to sweeping New York views. I've changed. She's changed. We're supposed to change. The next part of the story addresses her love-hate relationship with social media. And then an ad for laser therapy interrupts the story, an ad I'll remember forever because of what comes next. "I believe in privacy," she says, sipping her extra foam latte. "I think that's the New Hampshire in me. You know, we're actually going home next week for our engagement party." Sayers, who is engaged to financier Carrig Burkus, says she rarely discusses her personal life. But you get engaged, it feels like you should tell everyone, she says, beaming. To wit, Sayers and Berkus grew up together in Nashua, New Hampshire. They then grew apart. One night, I'm at a gallery, and they tell me someone from school is here, and it was him. And that was that. We moved in together pretty quickly, and we liked to laugh. He had the wall space, I had the art. Sayers glances at this reporter's recording device. She winces. This isn't as cheesy as it sounds, she says, wrapping her hands around the cup as if it's warm. It isn't. It's like art. You throw paint, you don't know what you're doing. A few hours later, a few days, this canvas, those hours of your life, have dried. They tell you what they are, what they need. Dried time. She breaks into laughter, releasing her hands. This is why I never talk about my private life, she says. It leads to me saying things like that. Sayers and Berkus will celebrate the engagement in Nashua with a backyard party. When asked why New Hampshire instead of New York, she looks out the window, resumes cradling her cold coffee. This isn't home, she says. Not yet. She then directs her disarming gaze to this reporter. What about you? She asks. Are you married? She is most relaxed now, her eyes alive, inquisitive, curious, as in her work. When I vomit, it's strawberries and cream. And then I vomit again because of what I was thinking only a little while ago. That this was our wedding cake. That we were in this together even when we were out of touch. That Dr. Actor was a season, no different from a winter. That every winter ends. And now there's nothing left in me but bile. There's no stopping the cramping in my soul, my gut. The idea of Carrig being the one to hold her, to walk down the street with her, to eat eggs with her. The idea of her art coming from his home and his bedroom and his love.
Eggs. On the way to Lynn, I stop at a diner off Route 3. I thought about calling Chloe, the girl quoted in the newspaper article, but I'm not a fan of the phone. I still can't shake this feeling that I can find him. John. The diner reeks of dish rags and food you eat because you have to, not because you want to, but because you need to send your wife a screenshot of a fucking salad or she might kick you out once and for all. The place is empty except for me and a family of four, a father and a mother, a boy and a girl, all of them sitting there with their heads buried in their phones. I am alone, and I am a nuisance, and when I tell the waitress I want a side salad and a cup of hot water, she glares at me. Are you serious? And pancakes, I say, a side of pancakes. She's off to the kitchen, and the family of four, they're still there, silent as ever, sucked into their devices, their phones, their tablets. To look at them, you'd think these bodies of ours are obsolete. I clear my throat and the boy looks at me. He's staring. The phones are killing our manners. That's what this is. Kid doesn't even know how to conduct himself in a restaurant. The waitress is coming with my water. And then she stops short. Oh, God, she says, gasping at me with the same kind of face as that kid, the one with the family. I look down at my shirt front. And there's a mess on my shirt. The bag leaked. In the men's room, I empty the bag and scrub my shirt with the lousy pink soap, and if Lo could see me now, she'd wonder what it's going to take. She'd have reason to wonder. In the mirror, my cheeks are shiny. I look old. I look like my old man. The light in here is vicious and bright. and I see wrinkles I didn't know about. I see lines deep in my neck, folds of skin. My tits are sagging. When did I get tits? I button up my shirt. The thing is, it could be worse. My kid could be in pain. He could be some heartless dolt like the kid out there at the table, the kid staring at me. My kid could be a psychopath, a kidnapper. Imagine you raise a child and the child turns out to be Roger Blair. Imagine that. I finish cleaning the cap of my bag. I screw it on and seal it up. I listen to this hiss, the sound of my body doing what other bodies do so quietly. I return to my table and eat my cold pancakes, my warm salad. Plate is hot, fresh out of the dishwasher. I steep my tea and I take out my iPad. I look up Roger Blair's parents, a dentist and a hygienist. Retired, Florida, then deceased, Florida. I knew that. I know that. And my gut says, leave the crazy be, Eggie. I don't need to find Roger. They tried. They didn't. But the one I want to find is John. In Providence, John changed his name to Theo Ward. I saw the Lovecraft in there. I think of his bedroom, the Spider-Man posters, how his mother could barely look at any of it. His father looked right through it. John is an obsessive boy, but loving. There's something else, his mother said. He left the house with his hamster. John loved with his whole heart. He was trying to get inside of these things, the Spider-Man on the walls, on his bed sheets. No doubt he harassed his mother for Spider-Man breakfast cereal in the days leading up to his disappearance. And who was the amazing Spider-Man, really? He wasn't born amazing. He was kind of a shrimp to start, if I remember correctly, a skinny, quiet kid named Peter Parker. I write the name down underneath the other names. I feel that pulse again, that good job, Eggie, pulse that I'm on to him. The waitress comes by and grins, sarcastic. Did you want to see a dessert menu? I give it right back. Well, yes, I do. Thank you, dear. And then I call my old partner, Jimbo Haskell. He met a girl, moved to Swampscott a few years back. He answers. He's the same old Jimbo, just more grown up. Eggie, you can call me Haskell, call me Ishmael, but don't call me Jimbo. I'm the one who called, but he's the one who does all the talking. He's bullshitting because he got a transfer. He's on a walking beat. Nothing Haskell hates more than walking. Mr. Haskell, I say, chuckling, can you run a name for me? What kind of run? He asks. Simple stuff, I say. Here's what I can tell you. It would be a lease, a bachelor, a one-bedroom, tops. There are likely to be newspaper subscriptions if you have access to those records. Haskell loves a good mission. This is like the old days, he says. What's the name? I look down at my notepad. Peter Parker. Hang 10, he says, and the line goes dead. The family of four is gone, and the restaurant is quiet. Too quiet. I slopped tea onto my notepad, so the words Peter and Parker are smudged. The tea is cold, I'm cold. I'm off. The waitress is here, bitching that the mother told the kids not to hesitate about making a mess all over the table, the floor. She actually told them they have people to do that, she says, huffing. Do I look like a custodian? Is this what we're doing? Are we, you know, raising brats? My phone rings. Jimbo, I say. Mr. Haskell, what do you got? Nothing, he says. Eggie, you know Peter Parker is a cartoon character, right? My heart is thumping. Haskell's running late, blabbering on about his foot patrol. Better stop off and get some sunscreen, as if the stuff in there is not going to kill you before the sun gets to you. I'm flipping through my notes and come across the emails Flory sent him. And I see that saddest sentence.
the last thing she wrote to him. "Theo, sometime we have to watch Grown Ups 2 together." This movie was their thing, same way Lo and I get about American Splendor. I look up Grown Ups 2. I know the basics. It's an Adam Sandler production. He's from New Hampshire. They made the movie there, too. John wouldn't go by Sandler. It's too big a name. I look closer. I follow my gut to the list of character names. Sandler plays a guy named Lenny Fader. My eyes stick to that name. Fader. You can tell by the picture that Fader's got it all, the wife, the kids, the friends. You might say that Bronson's been trying to bridge these two parts of his life together, the fantasy of having that kind of impossible superpower, being Spider-Man, the somehow equally unattainable fantasy of forging a family, living a well-adjusted, low-key life a la Fader. My gut hums. Haskell, I say, let's try finding a Peter Fader. He goes to run the search, and I ask the waitress if I can get my dessert to go, old peach cobbler, no whip, and I gather my papers. I adjust my bag. I ask the waitress for another favor, a cup of hot water to go. I know I'm on my way. I feel it in my bones, in my gut. I text Lo to tell her I'm going to be a while. I get another little yellow face with the eyes rolling, but then I get her blessing. Be safe and eat something decent. And then my phone rings. Haskell. Jimbo. Same difference. Eggie, he says, you're not going to believe this, but I got something for you. When Chucky was first having troubles, when the doctor told us it was time to go to Bradley, time to see specialists, I became obsessed with timing. I started reading about the universe, how it works, the wild roulette wheel of nature, the sheer volume of sperm, the odds of a fish hitting that egg. I couldn't stop. I couldn't sleep. I could only think about the day Lo and I conceived Chucky, the day I think we did, on a Saturday on the sofa. It was raining. We were in our old place, the one bedroom downtown near the Biltmore. We had the window open. The movie was no good, but it was the movie you want on a Saturday when you're coming down off your wedding, off your honeymoon, 4 days on the vineyard, and Lo's hand found my thigh. Not in the going-for-it way. I was married to her now. I knew her moves. I knew when she wanted it. She was just looking for the remote. I could have handed her the remote, but I wasn't into the movie, and it was raining, and I'm one of those people. I like the rain. I grabbed her wrist, teased her, and she was giddy. She was easily romanced in those days. We were like kids, and before you knew it, she was unzipping my pants, and I was on my back, and my head was digging into the remote, and she was feeling at me. I was feeling at her, and we went at it on the sofa. Unprotected. The volume on the TV erratic, the channels changing. We were in love, and everything was funny. The horror of the sounds coming from that TV, a commercial for a Thighmaster, an ESPN wrap-up, and a movie that was worse than our movie. Lo got her cookies. That's what she called it, and I blew a load in her, a thundering load. And she held on to my head, my hair. "Wow," she said, "I guess you were saving that up." That's the day we made Chucky. And I started to wonder if that was the problem, that we were on the sofa, not the bed, that I came too hard, that there was too much inside of me, that the timing was off, because the universe is timing. We exist, each one of us, because of timing. If you think about it, life is timing. I have bad timing. I got to Lynn about an hour too late. I just missed him. John Bronson became Theo Ward and Peter Fader. It seems like he left last night because today's papers, the Herald and the Globe, were lying on the floor mat outside of his door. The landlord had no problem letting me in, didn't ask to see a badge.
Never even saw the guy's face, he said. Not since the day he moved in. Paid his rent 2 days before it was due, slid the check under my door. Guy was like a church mouse. I found him, but I missed him. It's the same way with cancer. You beat it, but this bag hangs from your body. I called him the Beard, and sure enough, there's a shaving kit in his bathroom. Beard trimmers. The zipper sticks, so either the beard is gone or he's given up taking care of it. Everything here is clean. The windows were Windexed by someone who cares. The place smells like cookies, but I detect a chemical element, as if John was trying to make it smell like cookies. There are Yankee candles, vanilla cookies, and Christmas cookies. Sure enough, the electric sockets are jammed up by air freshener thingamajigs. The plug-ins, more artificial sweetness. To think of the Beard, John Bronson, going to Target like you and me, filling his car with Windex, candles, and throw pillows. He was trying to make this house a home. And the explicit pain of his efforts is evident in every corner of this apartment. His neatly made bed. For whom? And the two nightstands. He keeps a book by his bed. There's a book about Lovecraft, a reading for dummies sort of thing. I sit down on his bed and open the drawer in the other nightstand. There's a travel kit, a mini toothbrush, a mini tube of toothpaste, a bottle of eye makeup remover. The Beard was hoping for a girl. But there was no girl. But the most remarkable part of this place, aside from the heartbreak of his efforts, the real shocker, are the walls. Every inch of the walls are covered with drawings. Drawings of eyes. They're all the same artist. She signed in the corner of each one. A first name, a last name. But damn it, if artists aren't like doctors, who knows what that signature says? Tenderly, I peel one of the prints off the wall. John was careful with this heart. He used double-sided tape and he measured each spot, marked the walls before he hung his pictures. There is love in here. There is. My phone rings. My love. And it's already 7 p.m. Shit. Lo, I say. My God, I'm so sorry. I'm on my way out of here. Out of where? She huffs. I'm gonna be there before you know it. Did you get a gift? Shit. Again. I'm late. Not cute late. Bastard late. I denied my wife the right to be at Marco's engagement party with her husband. It was a shitty thing to do. She's at the bar wiping the counter with a cocktail napkin. She doesn't light up when she sees me coming, either. I start with an apology, but her eyes go to the flowers. Why are there two? One's for you. Her voice drops to a hiss. We're at a party. There's nothing for me to say. You can't be two places at once. She can read me. I know she knows I'm not even really here. Not fully. And maybe the boy got it from me, that tendency to live in his head. She sighs. Did you get a card? Shit. Magnified by all the gratitude, the red wine, the tiny slices of pizza, pancetta, more wine, laughter, the love. Did you see Bella's ring? It's a horrible thing when you didn't get the card, when you have no excuse, when you don't want to be where you are and you can't hide it. The Beard. Roger Blair. I know I should care about these people because Lo cares about them. I see myself in some apartment, like the Beard, covering the walls with Lowe's papers. Lo, what can I do? You can stop being an asshole, she says. A couple of people heard her. It isn't fair. This is my screw-up, and she's the one bowing her head, ashamed. Lo, I say, it ends now. I swear. I promise. Where were you just now? If she didn't love me, she wouldn't want to know, so this is a good sign, and I take it. I tell her everything, slowly, finding John Bronson, finding his apartment. But there's nothing in her eyes, no joy in Mudville. "Lo," I say, "this is huge." She picks up her purse and heads outside. And this is where it happens, the breakdown. We officially become those sad people, fighting people, that awful couple who comes to your party and spends the night outside fighting. "Lo, please." But she won't look at me. This used to be our place. When we first got together, we couldn't afford it, but we felt so rich, what with having each other. We'd come here once a month or so for no reason at all. It was always the best pizza you ever had, best aromas, best sex when you got home, best feeling of having believed in yourselves, having acted on that belief. All that was before we stenciled ducklings all over the walls, before Chucky. I try again. "Please, Lo, tell me what to do." She turns on me. She turns teacher. She isn't my wife right now. She's looking at me like an outsider, like an observer, the way I watch a perp in the box on the other side of the glass. She has saved it all up for now, her big takedown. It's not "this is your life," but "this is your problem." "You and that tea," she chides. "You want to steep it for 15 minutes. Those are the instructions, Lo. That's not me being OCD. She nods. "Read them closer, Eggie. They say it's ideal to steep the tea for 15 minutes, but it can be 10. They don't say it, but just by admitting that it doesn't have to be 15 minutes, they're telling you that life is a mess sometimes, that sometimes something comes up, and maybe you don't steep your tea for 15 minutes. Maybe your wife is exhausted from 4 trips to CVS in one day, from 2 drives to Bradley on her own as always, and maybe, just maybe, when she brings you that tea, maybe you don't always ask her if it was steeped for 15 minutes. Maybe you let it go because she has bags under her eyes, bags that weren't there before your bag. Well, we all know why you didn't go to the doctor. You don't want to be part of this family." I'm hollowed. I want to smash the bouquets together, tear them into nothing. "Lo, please. I'm trying." She tucks her hair behind her ears like Marco does. "Here's what. I'm going into that party because this is my kid, and this is my achievement, and it is my right to go in there and eat the pizza and have a few pops and celebrate something good for once in my life. And you don't want to do that? Fine. You're going to go, and I'm going to stay. Hold on here." She points her finger at me. Her nail is painted. Her nails are never painted. Now that she's this close, I can see her eyes, too. There's glitter on the lids. "No, Eggie. No." She turns to walk away, and I can't let this happen. I can't lose. Not everything. Not all at once. "You think you're so perfect? You and your kids? My kids, my kids, my kids, as if those are magic words, and if you say enough, those kids will be yours?" She is shaking. "Stop it." I can't stop. I am a train. "You think that's your kid in there? That's not your kid. He's got parents. I saw them when I got here. I heard his father talking about their big family vacations. And he's got a sister, too. He's got a mother, Lo. He's got a father. His name is Lorne, and the mother is Patsy. And when I got here, when I went looking for you, I heard them all chortling about the time they saw Hamilton and took up a whole row. A whole row, Lo. That's the size of their family. We're not them, and they ain't us. But you go on, Lo. You go on back in there. You make a fool of yourself. You try and worm your way into their family because you won't fucking let it be us. This is our family, Lo. It's you and me. Chucky isn't here, and he never will be. And you wanted family? You got it, kiddo. It's me. I'm yours. It's you and me. So stop trying to shove all these other kids into it because you and I got together. We were supposed to be enough. That was the idea. But you?
No. Don't think I don't see your nails painted and your face painted. Don't think I don't know that you're in there, pretending that I'm not out here. I thought communication started with a feeling, a thought. You talk because you have something to say. But I'm shaking. Those words didn't feel like mine. And now they're out there, which is proof that they were mine. They came out of my mouth. She's standing here, lording over me. I said too much to say sorry. I try to read her face, her teacher's face. I can't. Stop it, she says. Stop looking at me, and let me look at you. Inside the restaurant, people are clapping because someone made a speech. A loving speech. Not me, my hate speech. I want so badly to look down, to hang my head, but this is part of it, winning her back. It's what she said, let me look at you. It's a hard thing to do, the hardest thing I've done in so long. The thing I'm most afraid of with my boy. That he will look at me. That he will know where I've been. Eggie? She kisses the back of my hand. You do have to go see him. I know. It's in her voice. I'm okay. We're okay. For now. I wrap myself up in her and she cries a tiny bit, the tiniest bit, muffled, reluctant tears like she did so many times in the beginning, those first few days when Chucky was having problems, when there was still hope that he would be okay. So, she says, you're going to go back to Nashua? Yeah, I am. I hope you get this guy. You know I'm on your side. I know, Lo. You know I don't think you're nuts. You know I want you to win, to be right. I know how your mind works. I know how you see things. I know, Lo. But you do need to be that way at home, too. She pulls away. You know, she says, licking her lips, there's a professor in there I haven't seen in years. He got divorced. He's, you know, circling. And the whole time he's circling, trying to buy me drinks, told me 3 times about his new condo in Newport. She laughs. Eggie, I kept looking for you. I want you here. I'm sorry. She is serious. Newport condo serious. I'm here, I say. Good, she says. Then you'll stay here with me, and you'll go in there because I want to go in there, because that's how it works. She digs into her purse for throat coat tea bags. Oh, she says, I brought some of these, you know, for you. I take the tea bags and put them in my pocket. I know better than to thank her. It's embarrassing. The imbalance. The months she took care of me. And I make a stink about getting a present. I hold the door for my wife, and now she murmurs. Nobody can hear it but me. Thank you, Eggie. I put my hand on her shoulder. I squeeze. Sorry, Lo. Nashua can wait. It has to.
Chloe, every time we go to a potential spot for the wedding, it's the same. Carrig winces on the sidewalk when he spots the telltale white lights. My mother likes colorful lights. I talk him down If we rent the place, we can design the lighting. And then we go in and none of it feels right. It's all too Brooklyn, too. And then we have a few drinks and we laugh. And tonight is par for the course. We agree that milk and roses might be too beautiful for us. We're eating creamy polenta, soaked in candlelight, seated in another garden that isn't quite right. Not when you grew up like we did, with cavernous yards. We're laughing about the idea of our parents in here. Carrig's mother would be horrified by the bookshelves inside, the small portions on our small plates, the whole Brooklyn aesthetic of it, the rustic decor, the nonstop fulfillment of expectations. My mother would smile, but she'd be rolling her eyes at it. A vivid memory from childhood. My mother to a saleswoman in a furniture store. I hate whimsy. There has to be furniture for a young girl that has zero whimsy. Carrig pours more wine into my glass. Zero whimsy, he says. The only place we're going to get that is my parents' house. But we don't want to get married in the same place we have the engagement party, I say. And then I shake my head. He laughs, rubs my back. It's not too much too fast? God, no, I say, drinking my wine, the wine he poured. I'm just still thinking about the New Hampshire thing. It would be ironic if we blew all this time and money trying to find a place, going to all these restaurants, and then we wind up in Nashua. He shrugs, Mr. Bashful, the home state finding its way back into his voice. Or maybe it would be romantic. I mean, it's not like I want to move back there or anything, but you really can't beat the fall. Our backyard, I mean, that could be cool. Do you, though? Do I what? He asks, the tiniest bit defensive. Want to move back? I say. For a minute there, it sounded like you do. He shrugs. When we're older, he says. You know, like to retire. The waitress is back, asking about dessert, and I motion to Carrig. Your call. Already my head is spinning. You know, like to retire. I didn't think it through. Didn't move that far into the future in my mind. There are moments like this every day. Little stings, like mosquitoes. I can't picture us old, retired. Whenever I saw myself as an old gal, I saw myself with John. Honey, I say, I'll be right back.